The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, September 20th, 2025. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
And Sam, you've been guiding us through this this massive paper today.
It's always a pleasure. Yeah, it's dense material, Alex, no doubt. But, you know, it paints a remarkably clear picture, even if it's a volatile one.
Absolutely. And our mission today, as always, is crystal clear. We are here to really dig in and pull out every critical insight from today's Wall Street Journal. Think of this as your comprehensive shortcut. We want you to walk away feeling thoroughly informed on the key developments shaping policy, the economy, and culture.
Right. We'll go deep on the facts, unpack the implications, give you that full context.
Exactly. And Sam, looking at the Washington section first, there's this this really strong theme emerging, isn't there, about executive power.
That's the perfect lens, I think. We're seeing the administration using executive power quite forcefully to reshape things. Labor markets, private industry decisions.
It's a major assertion of control.
Definitely. Driven by fiat, really. Targeting immigration, corporate moves, it's all connected. Hashtag tie-guy Washington and the expanding scope of executive power.
Okay, let's kick off with immigration then. Specifically, this pretty seismic shift proposed for the H-1B visa program.
Right.
I mean, this visa has been, for years, the absolute lifeblood for the tech industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bringing in skilled foreign labor.
Especially engineers, software folks, often from India, historically.
Exactly. And now the administration's proposing something. Well, sounds almost prohibitive.
Yeah.
Like a tax designed to just shut down its widespread use.
It's much more than just tweaking the fees, Alex. It's a fundamental rethink of, you know, the cost of bringing in foreign talent.
So what are the numbers? How different is it?
Well, historically, you had a lottery system. The entry fee was tiny, like $215. And then if you got picked, maybe another $5,000 or so in filing fees.
Right.
Manageable.
Okay.
Now, they're talking about a $100,000 annual fee for each H-1B application.
Wow. $100,000.
Yeah.
Per worker, per year. That completely changes the economic calculation for these big tech employers, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It makes volume hiring through H-1B almost impossible for many roles.
So why such a drastic move? Is it about raising money, or is the goal really just deterrence?
The stated rationale coming from Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick is pretty explicitly protectionist.
Okay.
He says the goal is to make sure companies really have to hire Americans, and that if foreign workers do come in under this, they have to be the absolute top, top people.
So the fee acts as this massive barrier, pricing out firms using H-1B for, say, mid-level tech support or standard engineering roles.
Precisely. It forces extreme selectivity.
But this policy, it's actually causing some friction within the administration's own base,
yeah.
Like a kind of ideological split.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It really highlights this tension you often see between the sort of populist America First wing and the more pro-business, pro-innovation wing.
How does that play out here?
Well, the traditional Magier base tends to see H-1B as, you know, job displacement. Foreign workers taking good tech jobs from Americans. That's one side.
Right.
But then you have figures like David Sachs, who's actually the president's AI czar, deeply embedded in the administration, arguing the exact opposite.
What's his take?
He's saying this is counterproductive, especially for critical fields like AI development. His argument is the U.S. has to recruit the best global talent to stay competitive. Restricting that flow actually hurts American innovation in the long run.
That's a huge fault line. Protecting current jobs versus ensuring future tech dominance.
It's a classic political balancing act, and this policy really forces the issue.
Okay, so beyond reshaping existing labor visas, the administration's also creating entirely new paths to residency. And these seem very much focused on wealth.
That's right. They're rolling out the Gold Card program.
The Gold Card. What is that exactly?
It's basically an expedited path to permanent residency, a green card for individuals who pay a flat fee of $1 million directly to the U.S. Treasury.
$1 million. Just straight up.
Straight up. Or if a corporation wants to sponsor that person, the fee doubles to $2 million. Plus, there's a $15,000 vetting fee on top, non-refundable.
And this isn't just a proposal.
No, Lutnick confirmed this is happening fast. It's set to replace several existing, more complicated employment-based green card paths within the next month.
So a very clear shift towards a wealth-based immigration system, at least for certain categories.
Absolutely. And they're already talking about an even higher tier.
The platinum card.
The platinum card, exactly. Now, this one's still proposed because it needs congressional approval.
Why Congress for that?
Because of the tax implications, it would reportedly involve a $5 million fee.
Okay.
But the big draw isn't just residency for 270 days a year. It's a clause that would exempt the holder from paying U.S. taxes on their non-U.S. income.
Wow. That tax exemption that's potentially massive.
For a global billionaire, the $5 million fee could be pocket change compared to the potential tax savings on their worldwide income.
So it essentially creates a residency path with a major tax shelter built in for the ultra-wealthy.
Pretty much. Secure residency, mobility, but without the typical U.S. tax burden on global earnings.
And the big question hanging over all of this, the H-1B hike, the gold card, is the legality, right? Can the executive branch just create these things?
That's the critical point. Usually, Congress sets new visa categories or makes major changes to fee structures.
Or there's a long public process.
Exactly. A formal public notice and comment period. These kinds of sweeping executive actions are almost certainly going to face immediate legal challenges, accusations of bypassing the legislative process.
Okay, so this theme of expanding executive control, it's not just about immigration rules. It seems to extend right into the heart of the Justice Department.
Yes, and specifically how the DOJ appears to be wielded against political perceived adversaries.
The resignation of Eric Siebert, the U.S. attorney in Virginia, that seems like a prime example.
It really does. He was forced out, effectively. This came after the president publicly called for his ouster.
And the reason. What was his supposed failure?
It seems the main issue was his office not managing to build a successful mortgage fraud case against New York Attorney General Letitia James.
Who, of course, had pursued that major civil fraud lawsuit against the administration back in 2022.
Exactly. So the timing and the context strongly suggest political motivation.
It sounds less like law enforcement and more like political retaliation using the DOJ.
The evidence certainly points in that direction. And the pressure on Siebert's office wasn't subtle. Ed Martin, who heads this special working group reviewing cases against the president,
okay,
he apparently really leaned in. The journal mentions he used a grand jury to probe James, but also engaged in what they call unorthodox moves.
Like what?
Like being photographed, posing outside her home in Brooklyn in a trench coat, images that somehow made it to the press.
Seriously.
And sending a letter directly to her lawyer suggesting she should resign for the good of the state and nation. It's pretty extraordinary stuff.
And Letitia James isn't the only critic being looked at for this alleged mortgage fraud, is she?
No, not at all. The same working group has reportedly opened investigations into Democratic Senator Adam Schiff.
Key figure in the impeachment proceedings.
Right. And also Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, who was a prominent Biden appointee.
And they deny any wrongdoing.
Completely. But the pattern seems pretty clear. Using the investigative powers of the Justice Department to target or at least intimidate high-profile political opponents.
Okay, one more piece on this executive control theme before we move on. U.S. Steel and the Golden Share. What happened there?
This is the administration flexing its muscles directly over a private company's operational decision, using this new Golden Share authority.
What was the decision?
U.S. Steel, which is now owned by Japan's Nippon Steel, had announced plans to shut down steel production at its Granite City, Illinois plant this coming November.
Even though Nippon Steel had made big promises about investing in the U.S.
Exactly. They'd pledged $14 billion in U.S. investments. But this specific closure plan drew huge opposition, especially from the United Steelworkers Union.
A powerful union. So, how did the administration respond?
Very decisively. The Commerce Secretary directly told the U.S. Steel CEO that the administration would not allow the Granite City production to be shut down.
Even though U.S. Steel claimed they'd offset the production elsewhere.
Yeah, they pointed to expanded capacity at their Big River Steel facility in Arkansas. But Granite City had become politically symbolic. It represented those domestic production promises and, crucially, the union jobs.
So invoking this Golden Share authority is basically the government saying, we can overrule your private business strategy if it conflicts with our political priorities.
That's exactly what it looks like, especially when union interests or those prior investment pledges are involved. It's a clear assertion of control over corporate decisions, #2, domestic policy, culture wars, and congressional standoffs.
Okay, let's shift gears now to domestic policy. And if the theme in Washington was executive control, here it feels more like, well, volatility and depolarization, starting with healthcare and vaccines.
Yeah, a really significant policy reversal coming out of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP.
This is the committee that recommends vaccine schedules.
Right. And after a pretty contentious two-day meeting, they voted to basically scrap the previous positive recommendations for COVID shots for all adults.
Scrapped them. So what's the guidance now?
They've shifted to language around individual decision making.
That sounds subtle. But what does it actually mean for someone trying to get a vaccine? Does it affect access or cost?
It could have pretty immediate and significant effects. Losing that official ACIP recommendation is a big signal, especially to private insurers.
So insurance might stop covering it.
Well, HHS tried to clarify federal plans like Medicare, Medicaid, and ACA plans must still cover the shots. But for private insurance, it gets murky. This change could definitely create hurdles. Some people might suddenly face out-of-pocket costs depending on their specific plan and how the insurer interprets this new, weaker guidance. It kind of moves the vaccine out of the routine public health category and more into an elective choice category.
And this committee, the ACIP, has been under scrutiny itself, right?
Yeah.
Since Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. initiated a makeover.
Yes, it's been unusually public and political, and this vote absolutely reflected deep disagreement within the committee. There wasn't consensus at all.
What were the opposing arguments?
On one side, you had Retsef Levi, who heads the new COVID subcommittee. He argued that the CDC staff had consistently underestimated the risks and uncertainties around the vaccines, while also overestimating how effective they were.
Okay, questioning the risk-benefit analysis.
Right. But on the other side, many committee members, like Dr. Henry Bernstein, strongly pushed back. They emphasized that the vast majority of studies still show the benefits preventing severe disease far outweigh the rare risks.
And warned about the consequences of losing confidence.
Exactly. Bernstein specifically said, when vaccine coverage decreases because of loss of confidence, outbreaks happen. That's the public health perspective.
So a real clash. And it might not end there.
Apparently not. The disagreement was so sharp that the FDA is reportedly now considering whether it needs to launch a completely new formal review of the existing COVID vaccine approvals. That would be a huge deal.
Wow. That internal policy fight really mirrors the broader cultural polarization, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us, tragically, to the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's assassination.
Yeah, a horrific event. Kirk shot while speaking at Utah Valley University.
And instead of uniting people against political violence, it seems to have just poured gasoline on the conspiracy fire.
Completely. The official story is that a 22-year-old named Tyler Robinson acted alone, confessed, and was motivated by hatred for Kirk's rhetoric.
But that's not being widely accepted.
Not in many influential circles. The Journal calls it a tsunami of disbelief. The political climate is just so toxic and suspicious right now.
And the speculation is running wild, covering all bases.
Oh, absolutely. You're seeing a completely baseless conspiracy theories blaming everyone from transgender militants to the far-right groypers who actually opposed Kirk to Israel, even to factions within the MAGI movement itself. Basically, anyone with an agenda is using this tragedy to confirm their own narrative.
And prominent figures are fueling this disbelief.
Yes. Steve Bannon questioned the alleged confession texts, saying they seemed too stilted, too much like a script. Elon Musk just posted terrorist cell. David Paleologos, the pollster, notes that this kind of political trauma hitting our already incredibly polarized society is like perfect fuel for conspiracies.
And predictably, Congress jumped right in to use this politically.
Immediately. House Republicans put forward a resolution to honor Kirk and condemn political violence.
It sounds straightforward, but it was designed as a trap for Democrats, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Many Democrats felt deeply uncomfortable voting for something that honored Kirk, given his history of, you know, highly controversial statements like belittling the intelligence of Black women.
So they were put in an impossible position.
Exactly. Vote yes, and you implicitly endorse Kirk's rhetoric, which many couldn't stomach. Vote no or abstain, and Republicans frame you as being soft on political violence or even condoning hatred.
How did it shake out?
It was a real no-win. In the end, slightly less than half of the House Democrats joined the GOP in supporting it. People like Rep. Jared Huffman, who voted yes, admitted Republicans were forcing us to also, you know, at least implicitly, say that everything he said was true and good.
While others called it cynical.
Yeah, Rep. Becca Ballant called it the most cynical, craven move by Republicans, designed purely to score political points by framing Democrats negatively, regardless of the actual condemnation of violence. It just highlights the deep, deep dysfunction.
And that dysfunction is now pushing us towards a potential government shutdown again. another stunning fight looms.
Yep, we're right up against that September 30th deadline. Senate Democrats just blocked the Republican stopgap funding bill.
How did the vote go?
44 to 48. Fell way short of the 60 needed to advance.
And why did they block it? What are their demands?
They're playing hardball. They're demanding over $1 trillion in long-term health care spending in return for supporting this short-term funding measure.
$1 trillion? What specifically?
Things like extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies, restoring some recent Medicaid cuts. Major priorities for them.
And how are Republicans responding to that demand?
Not well. GOP leaders immediately called it a ransom payment. Majority Whip John Barrasso used that exact phrase, a ransom of over $1 trillion, just to keep the government open for 4 more weeks.
So no compromise in sight.
Doesn't look like it. Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, basically said, your take-it-or-leave-it approach isn't going to work anymore. But then Majority Leader John Thune said the Senate will just vote on the exact same bill Democrats rejected when they come back from recess next week.
Signaling zero intention to negotiate on those health care demands.
Pretty much. Which means the odds of a partial government shutdown at the end of the month just went way up.
Okay, let's look at how this polarized climate is affecting the legal system, too. Starting with President Trump's huge defamation lawsuit against the New York Times. What happened there?
Well, that $15 billion lawsuit got tossed out by a federal judge, summarily dismissed.
$15 billion, wow. And the judge's reasoning?
The judge, who was actually a George H.W. Bush appointee, was incredibly critical of the filing itself. He didn't pull any punches. Called the 85-page complaint a vitriolic screed.
A screed, not a legal document.
That was his assessment. He said it was decidedly improper and impermissible for a legal filing.
What was technically wrong with it?
He pointed out that the actual legal claims, the counts of defamation, were buried way back on pages 80 and 83. The rest was filled with repetitive and highly positive language about the president himself, which he deemed disorganized and just inappropriate for court.
So can Trump refile?
Yes, they have 28 days to try again, but the judge imposed a strict 40-page limit this time. And he emphasized that the court process will begin, will continue, and will end in accord with the rules of procedure and in a professional and dignified manner. A clear warning.
Interesting. While we're talking about legal battles and speech, there's this piece about Europe's Digital Services Act, the DSA. How could a European law threaten free speech here in the U.S.?
It's a really interesting and potentially worrying mechanism. The DSA imposes huge fines, potentially billions, up to 6% of global revenue on large online platforms if they fail to remove content deemed illegal in the EU.
Okay, but illegal where in the EU? Aren't laws different across the 27 member states?
Exactly. And that's the catch. The platforms have to comply with the strictest relevant law in any of the EU countries where they operate.
Ah. So if something is legal under the First Amendment here, but illegal under, say, Germany's hate speech laws?
The platform is pressured to apply the German standard globally because it's way easier and cheaper to tweak the global algorithm once than to manage 27 different sets of content rules and risk those massive fines.
So they default to the most restrictive standard?
Effectively, yes. And the DSA uses vague terms like removing content that has negative effects on civic discourse or constitutes gender-based violence. These are subjective categories that go far beyond clear illegality.
Which means platforms might suppress speech in the U.S. that is perfectly legal here just to avoid EU penalties.
That's the core concern. It essentially allows Europe to export its censorship standards and undermine core First Amendment principles, which protect even speech we find hateful or false.
And there's a real-world example of this cross-border enforcement.
Yeah, the article mentions the British comedian Graham Linehan being arrested at Heathrow Airport by British police because of tweets he posted while he was in the United States. It highlights the risk American speech potentially violating foreign laws, even when generated domestically. #3, global affairs, trade, and military posture.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to the global stage. And starting in the Middle East, the administration is pushing ahead with very large arms sales to Israel.
Yeah, a significant package. They're seeking congressional approval for almost $6 billion in new sales.
What kind of equipment are we talking about?
It's heavily focused on advanced hardware. About $3.8 billion is for 30 AH-64 Apache attack helicopters, and another $1.9 billion for over 3,000 infantry assault vehicles. High-end stuff.
And the timing of this? It comes right after that controversial Israeli strike in Qatar, right?
Exactly. The U.S. itself joined in condemning that strike, which targeted Hamas leaders but occurred in Qatar. A really key U.S. ally in the region hosts a huge American military base.
So moving ahead with the arms sale, despite that friction, it sends a message.
It does. It contrasts pretty sharply with the previous administration. Remember, President Biden temporarily held back shipments of certain bombs during disagreements over Israel's Rafah offensive. This administration seems to be signaling that, despite recent tensions or tactical disagreements, the fundamental military support and supply lines remain fully open and robust.
Okay, now turning to Afghanistan. This is quite a turnaround. Discussions about potentially reestablishing a U.S. presence at Bagram Air Base with the Taliban.
Yeah, the irony is pretty thick here, isn't it? Bagram was the absolute nerve center for U.S. operations for 20 years.
Until the withdrawal in 2021.
Right. And now officials from the current administration are actually talking to the Taliban about having a small U.S. military footprint there again.
For what purpose?
Primarily for counterterrorism operations. The idea seems to be using Bagram as a base for perhaps manned aircraft or drones to monitor and potentially strike extremist groups in the region.
And this is part of a bigger diplomatic effort.
Apparently so. It's being handled by Special Envoy Adam Boehler, and it's reportedly linked to broader talks about normalizing relations, things like potential prisoner exchanges, maybe some economic cooperation deals.
But is the Taliban actually open to having U.S. military assets back on Afghan soil? Even a small presence.
Well, the signals are mixed. A senior official in the Afghan Foreign Ministry, Zakir Jalali, publicly pushed back hard. He basically said a permanent U.S. military presence is a non-starter.
Citing history.
Yeah, citing the long history of Afghan resistance to foreign military occupation and pointing to the original Doha Agreement, which mandated the U.S. withdrawal. He seemed to draw a line. Economic engagement, yes. Military presence, no.
And the ultimate irony, of course.
Is that it was President Trump's first administration that negotiated that very Doha Agreement in 2020, the one that required the U.S. to leave Bagram and other bases in the first place. Quite a reversal.
Let's move over to Russia. There's a pretty stark warning coming from Western intelligence about Putin's intentions in Ukraine.
Yes, this was from MI6 Chief Richard Moore, a very pointed message, clearly aimed at the administration as it weighs its options for dealing with Moscow.
And the message was,
unequivocal. Moore warned that Putin has absolutely no desire to end the war in Ukraine unless Ukraine completely capitulates. Any talk of good faith negotiation from Putin right now is just a delay tactic. Moore's words were, he is stringing us along.
we often focus on the military angles, but you've argued the deeper, maybe more existential threat to Putin's system is actually economic. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think this is crucial context. The real long-term nightmare for Putin isn't necessarily NATO tanks. It's the economic success of the countries that escaped Moscow's influence after 1990 and joined the EU.
Like the Baltic states, Poland?
Exactly. If you look at their economic growth since the early 90s, their national GDPs have grown, on average, nearly 10 times over. Compare that to Russia itself or its neighbors who stayed out of the EU, like Belarus. Their GDP has only grown maybe four
That's a
times.
huge difference.
Massive. And so a free, stable, democratic, and prosperous Ukraine, a country Russia sees as culturally very close, would be like holding up a giant mirror reflecting the failure of Russia's own system.
It exposes the corruption, the reliance on just extracting resources.
Precisely. If Ukraine thrives economically while being democratic and aligned with the West, it fundamentally challenges the Kremlin's narrative. It suggests the problem isn't external enemies, it's Russia's internal political and economic model. That's why a successful Ukraine is such an ideological threat to Putin. It's why he focuses so much on historical grievances and nationalism, he can't compete on economic results.
And while that bigger strategic picture unfolds, we keep seeing these smaller, potentially risky incidents, like violating NATO airspace.
Right. Just this week, Russian fighter jets flew into Estonian airspace, stayed there for 12 minutes before NATO jets intercepted them.
And this wasn't the first time recently.
No, it was the second time in just 2 weeks that Estonia felt compelled to invoke Article 4 of the NATO treaty.
Which triggers consultations among allies.
Exactly. It's a formal step taken when a member feels its security or territorial integrity is threatened. These repeated, deliberate incursions suggest an escalation, a testing of NATO's resolve, and it's definitely fueling calls within the alliance for a stronger, more unified response.
Okay, one last item in this global section, bringing us back to executive power. President Trump ordering another lethal strike against a suspected drug boat.
Yes, this is reported as at least the third such military strike targeting alleged cartel vessels, primarily in Latin America.
And the legality of this is being questioned, using the military for drug interdiction.
Intensely questioned. Traditionally, drug interdiction at sea is a law enforcement mission, handled by the Coast Guard, focused on seizing drugs and arresting smugglers.
Not lethal force from the military.
Generally, no. The administration is justifying these strikes under the president's constitutional powers as commander-in-chief and the right to self-defense. But the big issue is Congress has never actually authorized military force, specifically against drug cartels.
Are people raising concerns internally, within the military or government?
The general reports that military lawyers have raised serious concerns internally about the legal basis for these strikes. But apparently those concerns have been largely overruled or ignored by senior leadership.
And Congress is pushing back.
Yes. Democratic Senators Adam Schiff and Tim Kaine have introduced a joint resolution explicitly demanding the U.S. stop any hostilities against cartels that haven't been authorized by Congress. The administration, meanwhile, hasn't provided clear public evidence to Congress proving these specific vessels were definitely involved in drug trafficking. So it's a real point of friction over war powers.
Okay, let's dive into the economy now. We just had a Federal Reserve meeting. They cut rates by a quarter point. But the newest governor, Stephen Murin, immediately dissented.
Yeah. Murin, who's only there for a short term, on leave from his White House job as the president's chief economist.
Right.
He was the lone vote against the quarter point cut. He wanted a bigger half point cut.
Aligning directly with the president's calls for lower rates.
Exactly. And interestingly, Murin also went public saying he does not believe that the administration's tariffs are causing inflation, which counters a pretty common economic argument.
So Murin wants faster cuts. How's the market reacting? Are they buying his view or the Fed's more cautious stance?
Oh, the market is definitely optimistic, maybe even overly so. Investors are currently pricing in expectations for two more quarter point cuts by the end of next year than what the Fed officials themselves are projecting.
We saw on the dot plot?
Right. The median dot plot, where each Fed official anonymously forecasts rates, points to rates around 3.4% at the end of 2025. But the market is betting it'll be lower, hoping for that perfect soft landing with quick rate relief.
Now, this quarter point cut, what does it actually mean for the government's massive $35 trillion debt? Does it help much?
It offers a little bit of short-term relief, but it doesn't really change the big picture. The cut immediately lowers the interest cost on newly issued short-term Treasury bills.
So the Treasury might borrow more short-term now.
They might shift some borrowing to the short end to save a bit on interest, yeah. But the government's total annual interest expense won't shrink much because most of that $35 trillion is locked in as longer-term debt at potentially higher rates from previous years. The overall debt burden remains enormous.
Okay, shifting to the tech world. Everyone's obsessed with AI chips, NVIDIA, etc. But there's this surprising comeback story for hard drives.
Really? Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? A classic tech plot twist. The sheer mind-boggling amount of data needed to train and run these huge AI models, plus just general cloud storage growth, has created this massive demand for old-school spinning hard drives.
Benefiting the companies that still make them.
Exactly. It's basically a duopoly, Seagate and Western Digital, and they are reaping the rewards.
Well, why hard drives? Aren't solid-state drives, SSDs, much faster?
They are faster, yes. SSDs are crucial for speed, for running operating systems and active applications. But when you just need to store colossal amounts of data like the petabytes used to train an AI model, hard drives still have a huge cost advantage per terabyte.
Cheaper to buy and operate for bulk storage.
Significantly cheaper, so much so that global revenue for hard drives is actually projected to nearly double by 2026. That's incredible growth for what many thought was a dying technology.
Meanwhile, Intel, they're trying desperately to get back in the game, especially in making chips for others. They got this big $5 billion deal with NVIDIA.
Yeah, NVIDIA investing $5 billion and partnering on some chip development. Tactically, that's definitely good news for Intel. It's cash, and it's a partnership with the hottest company in AI.
But analysts are saying it's not enough.
Yeah.
That Intel needs something more fundamental.
Right. The consensus among many experts is that for Intel to really compete with the foundry giants like TSMC and Samsung to become a go-to manufacturer for other chip designers, they need a structural change.
What kind of change?
They need to fully separate their chip manufacturing business, the foundry, from their own chip design business.
Why is that separation so critical?
Trust, basically. If you're a company like AMD or Qualcomm designing cutting-edge chips, are you going to send your secret sauce designs to be manufactured by Intel if Intel is also your direct competitor designing its own chips in the next building?
Probably not. You'd worry they might copy or learn from your designs?
Exactly. A clean separation is seen as essential to assure potential foundry customers that their intellectual property is safe. It positions Intel as a neutral partner, not just a competitor with a factory.
Okay, let's look at autonomous vehicles. There's news out of China about robotaxis getting closer to profitability.
Yeah, Pony AI, which is one of the big three AV companies in China, is talking about hitting a really key milestone soon. Single unit economics break even.
What does that mean in practice?
It means that for every new robotaxi they add to their fleet, that specific car starts generating more revenue than it costs to operate. It's the point where adding more cars actually starts making you profit per car, rather than just increasing overall losses.
A sign the business model is starting to work.
A huge sign. Their CFO thinks they'll hit that point by late 2025 or early 2026. It's driven by expanding the fleet size and getting operational costs down. Once you hit that metric, you can really start scaling aggressively.
All right, let's turn to corporate strategy and some big brand names. Starbucks is in a tough spot, right? Six quarters of sales drops.
Yeah, they've been struggling. And the new CEO, Brian Niccol, is making a big bet, spending hundreds of millions, not necessarily on being faster or cheaper, but on improving the service and the ambiance.
Going back to that third place idea, the comfortable spot between home and work.
Exactly. He seems to believe that's Starbucks' core DNA, and that's where they need to reinvest, especially as rivals like Dutch Bros and Luckin Coffee are really hammering them on speed and price.
So how do you spend hundreds of millions on ambiance? What are they actually doing?
They're rolling out this new standardized service model called Green Apron Service. It involves retraining staff on things like making meaningful eye contact. And they're drilling this ELATI acronym for handling customer issues. Listen, apologize, take action, thank, and ensure satisfaction.
Eye contact and acronyms. Can that really work during the morning rush?
That's the challenge. They claim they're also investing heavily in more staff hours and better tech to manage the flow of mobile orders versus in-store orders. The idea is to free up baristas just enough to make those connections without slowing things down too much. It's a tricky balance.
Meanwhile, Victoria's Secret seems to be reversing course again on its brand image.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The current CEO, Hillary Super, is explicitly pushing for a new era of sexy.
But didn't they just spend years trying to move away from that super sexy image toward
Right.
more comfort and inclusivity?
They did. And Super basically says that strategy was too watered down. Her argument now is that things like comfort and value are just table stakes, the absolute minimum expected.
So what drives sales then, according to her?
Emotional connection. She believes the brand needs to be aspirational again, more fashion forward, re-embracing that sexy element to create desire, not just meet basic needs. It's a definite pivot away from the pivot.
Wow. Okay, lastly in this section, this story about Andrew Left, the short seller, trying to get his criminal fraud case dropped by appealing directly to the administration.
It's quite something. Andrew Left, famous for his Citroen research reports, the guy who tangled with GameStop. He's facing a serious 18-count criminal securities fraud indictment. Could mean real prison time.
And his strategy is political lobbying.
It seems pretty overt, yeah. He's trying to get a pardon or have the DOJ drop the case entirely. The Journal details how he's made multiple appearances on Fox Business praising the administration's economic policies.
And even got FaceTime with the president.
Reportedly got a photo op at a golf tournament at Trump International. He seems to be banking on the idea that this administration, this DOJ, has shown willingness to drop other high-profile white-collar cases.
Like who?
The article mentions a former Nebraska congressman, a California restaurant executive whose cases were dropped, and of course, the pardon for Nikola founder Trevor Milton.
So Left is hoping his public support and perhaps connections might get him similar treatment.
It appears so. He and his lawyers apparently have a meeting scheduled with the DOJ this month to directly push for dismissal. It's a bold strategy, trying to leverage political favor to influence a criminal prosecution. Hashtag V social, cultural, and lifestyle deep dives.
All right, let's move into some of the more human stories, the cultural deep dives, starting with a really powerful personal account about dealing with a rare cancer.
Yeah, this piece is about chordoma, which is a type of tumor that grows along the spine, incredibly rare, like one in a million, only affects about 300 people in the US each year.
And the author talks about the feeling of isolation that comes with such a rare diagnosis.
Absolutely. Describes this profound sense of loneliness and even neglect when first trying to navigate the medical system. Because it's so rare, there just aren't many specialists, not much established research, no standard playbook.
And that neglect often comes down to basic economics, right? Not much incentive for drug companies or even government research to focus on such small patient groups.
That's a huge part of the problem. When funding agencies prioritize common diseases like breast cancer or lung cancer, rare cancers often get left behind. There's just not the same market incentive or public pressure.
So patients and families have to step up themselves.
Exactly. The article highlights the critical role of patient-founded organizations. It mentions the Adenoid Cystic Carcinoma Foundation as an example. These groups often become essential for raising money and driving the specific research that wouldn't happen otherwise.
But despite the challenges, this particular story has a hopeful outcome.
It does, thankfully. The author eventually found a specialized team and underwent a very aggressive treatment plan, high-dose radiation followed by complex surgery at Johns Hopkins.
And the surgery was successful.
Yes, a complete removal, which offers a really significant chance of a cure, maybe 60-70%. And the surgeon offered this vital perspective: don't feel that everything is dismal. It underscores how patients with rare diseases often have to become their own experts, their own advocates.
Okay, from the profound challenges of rare disease to something completely different. The Super Bowl of wastewater treatment.
Ah, yes, the Operations Challenge, held this year in Chicago. It's an annual competition for wastewater professionals.
What's the point?
It's designed to simulate high-pressure emergency situations and really hone the critical skills needed to keep our water system safe and functioning. And apparently, it's gotten incredibly competitive.
Like real rivalries.
Oh, yeah. There's this intense battle described between the reigning champs, a team called Elevated Ops from Denver, and their main rivals, Controlled Chaos from South Carolina. Both teams are gunning for legendary status in the wastewater world.
Trying to be number one in the number two business, as one of them put it.
I love it.
So what do they actually do in this competition? Is it like an obstacle course?
It's basically a five-event pentathlon testing different skills, mental and physical.
Okay, break it down.
First is safety involves rescuing a dummy from a simulated manhole, testing knowledge of gas hazards and safety protocols. Then there's pump maintenance, fixing a malfunctioning pump. Third is laboratory, doing quick chemical analyses on water samples. Fourth is process control, basically a written knowledge test.
And the fifth. Sounds like there's an intense one.
The collections event, that's the highlight apparently. It's the speed event, like the 100-meter dash of sewage ops. Teams race against the clock in rushing water to cut out and replace a leaking section of sewer pipe.
While water is flowing through it.
Yep. Requires incredible speed and precision. The article notes that years ago, cutting the pipe in under 10 seconds was amazing. Now the top guys, like the captain of Controlled Chaos, are doing it in under 6 seconds.
Wow, that's impressive.
It really is. And while they're fiercely competitive, the underlying point is serious. It sharpens skills, builds teamwork, and prepares them for real emergencies, all without, as one participant gratefully noted, risking a baptism of raw sewage.
Okay, thank goodness for that. Let's move to the skies now. There's a debate brewing over pilot training, specifically the 1500-hour rule for first officers.
Right. This rule came about after the Colgan Air crash back in 2009. Congress mandated in 2013 that airline first officers need 1,500 hours of flight time, a huge jump from the previous requirement of just 250 hours.
The idea being more experience equals safer pilots.
That was the logic, yes. Give pilots a couple of years of flying in various conditions before they get into the right seat of an airliner.
But now there are critics saying just logging hours isn't the whole story, that the quality of those hours matters more.
That's the core of the critique. The argument is that simply accumulating 1,500 hours doesn't guarantee a pilot has faced a wide range of challenging situations.
How do most pilots get those hours?
A huge percentage, the article suggests maybe 85%, build that time primarily as flight instructors.
Which mean?
Which often means flying the same simple routes in good weather, day after day, teaching basic maneuvers. You might rack up hours, but you're not necessarily getting experience with complex emergencies, bad weather navigation, or high-stress decision-making. Some argue it can even ingrain bad habits.
And there's a potential conflict of interest, too.
Yeah, the incentive for an instructor might be to keep students longer just to build their own hours towards that 1500 mark.
So, what's the alternative view? How does this compare to, say, military pilot training.
That's the key contrast. Ex-military pilots only need 750 hours to qualify for an airline job. Why? Because their training is incredibly rigorous, structured, performance-based, and mission-focused.
They're flying complex missions in tough conditions.
Exactly. High-stakes flying from the get-go. So the argument from critics of the 1,500-hour rule is that regulators should focus less on the raw number and more on mandating specific types of quality experience, more instrument flight time, more night flying, more complex cross-country flights to ensure pilots really have that deep well of experience to draw on when things go wrong, making sure they have, as one source put it, air under his butt during moments of crisis, not just hours logged in calm skies. Hashtag TACX, quick hits, arts, and final reflections.
All right, time for some quick hits from across the paper, starting with sports and a real head-scratcher from the WNBA.
Yeah, the Indiana Fever just won their first playoff series in 10 years, which is great for them.
But the paradox is,
they did it without their superstar rookie, Caitlin Clark. She was out with leg and groin injury.
And her performance before the injury hadn't been great.
Actually, it had noticeably slumped. Her three-point shooting percentage had dropped way down to about 28%. And statistically, the team's record was identical with her and without her. 12 wins and 10 losses in both stretches.
So her absence didn't hurt them.
In that specific playoff series, apparently not. The team found a way to win without her. Doesn't mean they don't need her long term, of course, but it's a fascinating statistical quirk.
Okay, over to baseball. The San Diego Padres are bringing back the sacrifice bunt. I thought Moneyball killed the bunt.
Huh. Apparently not entirely. You know, the whole Moneyball data analytics revolution largely proved that giving up an out just to move a runner 90 feet usually leads to scoring fewer runs overall.
Right. Statistically inefficient.
Generally, yes. But the Padres, a team that's never won a World Series, are having a winning season this year, and they're explicitly embracing small ball, including the sack bunt.
And it's working with them.
Seems to be part of their formula. Two of their players, catchers Freddie Freeman and Elias Diaz, are actually leading the entire league in sacrifice bunts. It's a throwback, suggesting maybe there's still room for situational tactics over pure probability sometimes.
Interesting. On the art scene, Woody Allen is still working, despite controversies. New novel out.
Yep. He's got a new novel called What's With Baum. It's described as a tragicomedy about a neurotic Jewish journalist making bad choices. Sounds familiar.
Blurring reality and fiction, perhaps.
Seems to be his thing. The article also includes some reflections from Allen as he nears 90, calls his life a series of silly mistakes, but also says thinking about death is easier now it's closer. Kind of a fatalistic acceptance.
Okay, let's talk travel and style. Airport lounges are getting ridiculously fancy.
Oh yeah, it's an arms race. Forget just a quiet place with stale coffee. These high-end lounges, Amex Centurion, Chase Sapphire, Capital One Venture X, are now core selling points for those premium credit cards with huge annual fees.
What kind of perks are we talking?
Speakeasy-style bars, full three-course meals, spa treatments, nap pods, sometimes even private cars to whisk you to your gate. They're turning the airport experience into a luxury destination itself, at least for those willing to pay the $600 plus annual card fees.
And at the other extreme, some people are actively traveling to dangerous places. Level 4, do not travel zones.
Yeah, this trend of dangerous tourism, people paying to visit places like Somalia or Syria.
Why?
Seems to be about seeking authentic cultural immersion, wanting to see the reality behind the headlines, challenging themselves. They rely heavily on trusted local guides and sophisticated risk management tools, like conflict mapping apps.
Are tour companies involved in this?
There are specialized operators, like Untamed Borders, mentioned in the piece. They cater to this market, but are very careful to avoid active war zones. They focus on areas that are maybe post-conflict or stable enough for carefully managed trips. Still risky, though.
Shifting to the home office. Personalizing your desk isn't just about looks anymore. It actually helps productivity.
That's what experts are saying. Moving beyond just aesthetics, having sentimental objects, things that provide comfort like a nice cashmere throw, or even just smooth stones to handle can apparently boost creativity and give you a greater sense of control over your workspace.
And even handwriting helps.
Yeah, they mentioned this concept of visual motor contingency. Basically, the physical act of writing with a pen or pencil, coordinating hand and eye, helps embed ideas in your memory better than just typing. So maybe keep a notepad handy.
Good tip. And in men's fashion, the trend is less is more. Quiet swagger.
Kind of a rejection of flashy logos. The move is towards understated, high-quality clothing without obvious branding. Relaxed fits, focusing on interesting textures like linen, corduroy, and maybe supporting smaller, craft-focused labels. It's about signaling tastes subtly, not shouting labels.
And the advice for guys stuck in a work uniform rut.
Whether you're a lawyer in suits or a fitness coach in track pants, the advice is to consciously reconnect your clothing choices with your personal identity. Use simple tailoring, add small personal touches, break out of the monotony to feel more authentic.
Okay, tech and environment now. Solar-powered cars are actually becoming a thing.
Getting very close. Thanks to huge gains in solar panel efficiency and overall vehicle efficiency, companies like Aptar and Tello are launching EVs that can genuinely get a useful amount of daily charge just from the sun.
How much charge?
Depending on the car and sunlight, maybe 10 to 40 miles per day. For someone with a short commute, that could mean rarely needing to plug in at all. There are even aftermarket solar roof racks coming out for existing EVs.
That's cool. But meanwhile, in California, their green energy policies are backfiring.
It's a real paradox. California has aggressively pushed against in-state oil production. As a result, the state now imports almost 80% of the crude oil its refineries need, much of it coming long distances on polluting tankers.
Increasing emissions elsewhere.
Exactly, and it's driving up gas prices dramatically. The average in California is now about $1.45 higher than the national average.
And the solution they're considering makes it worse.
To prevent prices potentially hitting $8 a gallon, politicians are now thinking about allowing refineries to produce dirtier blends of gasoline, which would directly increase smog and local pollution. It's a case where the intended environmental policy seems to have created an energy crisis that forces environmentally damaging choices.
Wow. Okay, finally, Mars. Still tantalizing hints of past life, but no proof yet.
Right. The Perseverance rover found this interesting arrow-shaped rock in an ancient riverbed. It contains minerals vivianite and greigite, which on Earth are often associated with microbial activity.
So it could be a sign of ancient marshy microbes.
It could be, but researchers are cautious. These minerals can also form through non-biological processes. So it's intriguing evidence, but not definitive proof.
And getting proof requires bringing samples back.
That's the only way to know for sure. But the Mars Sample Return Mission, the joint NASA-ESA project to bring those rock cores back, is currently stalled. It's
Yeah.
way over budget. Estimates are now $8 billion or more and facing major delays. So the answer remains locked on Mars for now.
And just before we wrap up, we should quickly acknowledge a couple of notable passings.
Yes, the journal notes David Cayley passed away at 77. He was known as the IMAX guru, worked closely with directors like Christopher Nolan and James Cameron, really obsessed with ensuring the best possible viewing experience for audiences.
A dedication to quality.
Absolutely. And also Laurie Cannon, who died at 74. She was known as the AIDS Angel of Chicago, founded Vital Food Pantry and meal delivery services during the height of the crisis, and co-founded the Legacy Project Chicago, which honors LGBTQ history. Two significant losses.
Indeed. Sam, as we pull all these threads together from today's journal, what's the overarching theme that stands out to you?
You know, Alex, listening back to our conversation, it really strikes me how rapid and frankly, how contested policy shifts are right now. You see it everywhere. The huge H-1B restructuring, the administration using the golden share to dictate corporate moves, that fierce internal battle at the CDC over vaccine guidance. It feels like a pattern. The administration tries to assert centralized control, often bypassing traditional processes, using executive orders or regulatory changes, and almost immediately you get intense pushback, legal challenges, political polarization, cultural warfare. It creates this environment of constant volatility where almost every domain feels unstable.
That dynamic where established authority is constantly being challenged, where
Yeah.
information itself is so polarized, it really brings us back to that column we touched on, the one about gatekeepers and national traumas.
Yeah, that piece argued that the old filters are gone, right? The handful of news outlets or government bodies that used to kind of curate what information reached the public.
They're gone. And the column's point was because those gatekeepers are gone, the responsibility now falls, well, squarely on the individual.
On you, the listener, you're now the one who has to sift through information that's often weaponized, sensationalized, designed to provoke rather than inform. You have to be your own filter, your own synthesizer.
Which leads to maybe a final provocative thought for everyone listening to consider today. In this environment where foreign laws might try to curb your speech, where every tragedy gets instantly twisted for political points, where major policies shift via executive whim rather than broad consensus, how do you maintain your own balance, your own dignity as that column put it. How do you effectively take on that role of being the gatekeeper, not just for what information you let in, but maybe just as importantly, what noise you actively choose to tune out, just to stay grounded in these pretty chaotic times?
That's a heavy question, but a necessary one, I think.
Something to reflect on.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material today. We'll talk to you next time.